Hendrix is my go-to. My go-to yes. chin.
Okay, good go-to for a chin, yeah.
And I've messed around with others, like mm-hmm. Plymouth and Peelers, but like Hendrix my go-to. There's that little cucumber note.
Yeah.
Easy. But what? I want that dry martini. Come on, Beefeater.
Beefeater for the dry one? Really? Okay, what about like Bombay?
I don't like Bombay. That
really?
That's my weird one. Like I don't.
Wow.
I don't like Bombay Sapphire. I prefer Tanqueray between the two.
Okay, Tanqueray. That's a pine tree and a half. That's just literally like straight. That's...
I know that, but it works there. Bombay. I just don't. Doesn't work for me.
You just like to treat yourself better than Bombay, huh?
Did you know that over $5 trillion exchanges hands on a daily basis? That's an average of over $220 billion an hour. Now, how does this much money move every single day, and why does it move the way it does? Here on Drunkenomics, two bartenders who also happen to be students at the University of Nebraska Graduate School of Business are going to sit down and drink to the global economy and try and translate it into English. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a stiff one, and have a drink with us to the comedy that is the global economy.
Guys, and welcome back to Drunkenomics, the drinking podcast with an economics problem or two. Sorry we were gone last week. Some of us were away on business.
Yeah.
Some of us were away at dinner.
Some of us were wearing both.
And some of us did both. No, we missed you. We're glad to be back.
Yep.
We hope you guys are glad that we're back. And it's pretty wild. We got 2 weeks to catch up on.
I know, seriously.
But
nice.
As always, very, very quickly, this is a podcast about economics, but it is not financial advice. Like, it may sound like advice, it isn't. We are not advocating for any positions, any trades, anything like that. So please remember, do your research before you make a decision based on anything we say.
Of course.
Nothing we're talking about is embargoed information. Everything is publicly available. So this is not the opinion of our employers, unless our employers happen to agree with us, which I'm sure happens, which is why they make money. But again, this is not a communication from them at all, which is why we do our best to keep them out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, welcome back, guys.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like James said, everything that we talk about is not embargoed information. That we're quoting articles on really well-known websites like CNBC or publications or, you know, newspaper articles, if you want to even go back that far. But yeah, we're quoting things that we've seen from Wall Street Journal, Reuters, CNBC. I know you like The Economist. I don't have that subscription, so
That's okay.
That's okay, dude.
And you're getting it.
I need to send you my Wall Street Journal stuff too. So, but anyways, so it's stuff like that we see on Bloomberg, and we're like, hey, that was very interesting. Let's talk about it. So, if you guys want to check out where we're citing the sources that we're citing, you can always find us at Drunkenomical. That's Drunkenomical. You can find us there on X. Why is it X? I don't know
until,
why.
Until they start asking for money. But the second Elon asks for money, we're no longer on X. I'm just going to say that, guys.
Yeah. You know what? Whatever.
The X will be an X.
It will be an X. It'll be an X social media platform, if that were the case. But, you know, we also have Threads, too. You know, I don't know anything about Threads. But we're on Threads. Yeah, we're there. We're there. We have an account. Same handle that I mentioned earlier. Of course, Instagram and Facebook. The Metaverse, which is no longer the Metaverse, which is now back to Facebook. So it's weird. Like Facebook, formerly known as the Metaverse, formerly known as Facebook. So that you can find us there too. And we very much appreciate any interaction there. And there you can also find our Discord link. Is that what you call it? The Discord link?
Yeah, link to Discord.
To all. You can
invite to the Discord.
Yeah, that's
free wall, join
invite
up.
To the Discord. That's what it is.
Join us in any of our myriad fun chats where we interact with you. You guys interact with each other. It's a pretty sweet time. I've been hugely remiss.
Yeah.
What is your name? And why is it Aaron Wong?
Why is my name Aaron Wong? That's a really, really good question. My name is Aaron Wong because the VIX is still under 23. We need to readjust that at the beginning of the year, by the way.
We really do, yeah.
But I am more gracious host. So
absolutely.
So glad you all can be with us. What is your name again?
I am James Goldwater, less gracious host, as is my, I don't want to say final form, but my most comfortable form is being less gracious.
Yeah, I was going to say, you seem really comfortable where you are.
I like to point at the problems. I don't necessarily have a solution, but I just need everyone else to agree that,
of course,
like, that's a problem.
This is an issue. This,
right.
Can we
all agree that's an issue?
Well,
what's your plan?
Real quick and see
first, we need to agree that that's an issue.
Can we agree that's an issue first? And,
and then we'll worry about
and
what
if you agree.
Do.
Yeah, and if you agree, like, I don't want you to just agree. Convince your friends that it's also an issue, and then I might think about coming up with a solution. Yeah, but dude, the VIX had a very interesting price action last week. I mean, two random spikes. It crossed above 1950 a few times. So
for like the first time this quarter.
I know. Which I thought that that was actually going to propel you into becoming the more gracious host at some point this year.
I did too.
But it didn't. But we all know September is just that month. It's that month of the year where the markets just have a lot of reluctancy. I don't know why, but if you just look at the S&P performance this year, we have a, like if you bought in $1,000, you know, into the S&P just passive indexing beginning of the year this year, you're up 22% until or 25% up until the beginning of September. And September cratered a little bit. No big deal. And this is what it does every year, right? Every year, it seems like if there's a bull market, September just happens to be the month where everybody just has that reluctancy. Do we aggressively buy too hard from months 1 through 8 this year? You know, whatever. And then you Billy know. Joe sings that song, Wake Me Up When September Ends, and that the markets are doing the same deal.
And now it's October.
I'll go to sleep.
and now it's October.
Happy October. Yeah, happy October. Happy Q4, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, this is the last quarter of the year.
For election
year. Exactly. Hey, guess what? Next quarter, man. Next quarter is the start of a new election year.
What killed me is that the markets tried to recover in weekend action and after hours action. They tried to they did their best to give Monday like a today, I guess.
The Monday after, a
real boost going into trading hours on the news that like the federal government wasn't going to shut down, that they like at the very last minute had gotten a 45-day continuing resolution going. Which just means that the next time this shutdown bullshit happens will be like the week before Thanksgiving. So hooray!
Oh yeah, exactly.
This is not financial advice, but it is very simple. It's that if you are a federal, buy your turkey now, put it in your freezer, or buy your turkey mid-October, put it in the freezer. Don't wait for, and then save your money in November, because let's be fair.
If you're a federal government employee, the
entire problem, and I don't want to get political on this, the entire problem this time around wasn't even inter-party, you know, it wasn't problems between the parties, it was problems within one of the parties. So it's like, well, that's great.
Yeah.
Kevin McCarthy can't get his own house in order, and
Kevin McCarthy, you know, and I don't know what's going on in Washington, but I like so far from what I've seen, I think you can agree with me on this, but Kevin McCarthy is not a strong leader.
No.
Right? No, he's not.
I don't know why he wants the job. It's very clear he wants the job.
Yeah.
And Jim, my view kind of on things is if you're someone who desperately seeks to be in charge of things, you probably shouldn't be in charge of things.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I don't mean to demean the Republican Party in this sense.
Yeah, I kind of do.
And I see, yeah,
to be
I know,
fair,
yeah,
I'm more than happy but, to be in the Democratic Party too when they do stupid shit. Yeah, so let's be fair.
Yeah, and I don't think the Democrats are, I don't think they're innocent of what I'm about to say either.
Nope.
But the Republican Party is
very
divided.
I'm not going to say either, but I agree. They're not innocent.
Well, like I said, well, I just said it, right? The Republican Party is very divided. It's unbelievably divided right now.
Mm-hmm.
There is someone to blame for that. I don't want to point fingers at anybody, but it's incredibly divided. And I think that's you're seeing it with the speaker, right? You know, with Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
Like the reason why we couldn't get behind him was because, I don't know, we all know that there are Republicans that are semi-Democrats, and we all know that there are Democrats that are semi-Republicans. I can name a few names, but I won't. And I think Kevin McCarthy was just one of those guys on the Republican side that, and he's a congressman from California was what he was. So
he still is technically, but.
So he still is technically Speaker of the House. He was a tough guy. He's a good public speaker. I'll give him that much. He's a good speaker. He's good at the podium. But he, you know, I think where he stands on the political spectrum, he was just kind of in that gray area, which, to be honest with you, I'm okay with. And nobody could get behind him from the Republican Party standpoint. And he was also, you know, I think the fact that he's not that good of a leader, he had a really difficult time convincing people why he's actually capable of doing the job.
Yeah.
So
I think he said he has two problems as I see it. One, he has a hard time convincing people why he should be in charge. He's not particularly well respected within his own caucus.
No, not at all. Not even a little bit. So, yeah.
And here's but worse, 17 members of his caucus are insane. Not insane. Not like medically judging, like only like 5 really are crazy. But like 17 members have no interest in being in like actually running anything. They like as opposed to just like running it into the ground. And so the problem is that would be fine if he had a majority that was more than them. But he has a majority of 3. So like, right. Like he's got too many people that are like, I have this great idea. What if I punched that cop? And it's like, that's not a great idea. That's not a good idea. The problem is he has 17 of them, and
yeah.
And well, if he had a majority of 20, he could have 17. It'd be fine. He could be like, well, they're crazy. Let's just, you know, like,
yeah.
Eh.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, this is a good, you know, this is a good pour one out segment. You know, pour one out for Kevin McCarthy, pour one out for the, like, God, man, I wish.
Yeah, Matt Gaetz, certainly, God. Well, the truly hinged member of Congress from the westernmost part of Florida, the panhandle.
Yeah.
Filed paperwork today to remove him from office, to have him removed from the speakership. So, you know, if you thought that what, like the 18 rounds of votes that damaged markets because it took that long to get him in was nothing. Let's just see how this goes on a 45-day CR.
You know, last week I had, some people don't want to call it this, but I had the pleasure of listening to Anthony Scaramucci talk. Great speaker. I don't care what you say. I don't care where on the fence you are. Yes,
just like as a public speaker, I don't care about the content of his message. Like, is he a good public speaker?
Unbelievable speaker. Like so, and like not even like he's like captivating and like Barack Obama is captivating, right?
Absolutely.
Great speaker. Barack Obama is the best public
amazing,
speaker.
Amazing, but it's prepared. Off the cuff, very weak.
Yeah, exactly. Scaramucci was great both ways, right? But when he spoke, and I got to meet him for a little bit, very, like, unbelievably nice. You know, I don't know if it was a persona that he was giving off, but unbelievably nice when I met him. So that's all I have to say about him. But like when he spoke in a very relatable way. He was like he was like talking to you like, you know, you're sitting next to him at the campfire, and I was like, man, this guy's really cool, relatable. But I mean, he talked, his claim to fame is that he was the press secretary for Donald Trump for 11 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bring him up because I was like, you know, he talked about Washington and he talked about how nobody in Washington likes to tell the truth, right? Like everybody there is a snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
And if you do tell the truth there, you're going to
doesn't
be...
doesn't work long.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't work long. And both parties just seem to be going further and further away from the middle. But that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like the political system is so divided and is so pulled in two
it's
different
so
directions.
Monolithic so
Yeah, exactly. So the moderates, and that's what Scaramucci was saying. Like, the Republican Party is so divided. I'll break the ice, whatever. You have the Trumpsters and you have the anti-Trumpsters, right?
And both
the Republicans for Trump and Republicans for not Trump are very present, very, very loud. And the GOP, the reason why Trump has so much momentum is because there's the half the party for Trump, half the party is for 18 other candidates, right?
So, yeah. Like, it's a hell of a lot easier to hear what people are chanting when half the crowd's chanting one thing and the rest of the crowd is chanting different things.
19. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's essentially what Scaramucci was saying. And that's the reason why I bring him up. But I think it's a pretty interesting political environment.
I mean, we can touch on like the fun of politics and economics. And we're going to in a little bit, but
yeah, you know, so, but anyways, I just feel like that was a, you know, that's a good pour one out for Kevin McCarthy.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, I don't know. We did have a Fed meeting not too long ago. I don't know what else you want to talk about. You know, the Fed meeting was essentially my big takeaway from the Fed meeting was Jeff Gundlach saying T-bill and chill, which I thought
that was a fun one.
It was so funny.
I did enjoy that. No, I have enjoyed some of the, some of the banking CEOs coming out after saying like, hey, yeah, maybe the Fed. I mean, I think it was Jamie Dimon even said last week that towards the end of the week that actually the Fed might have to raise rates again, like just to stabilize like certain sectors from his perspective. And I was like, didn't see that coming from you. I think you're right, but I didn't see that coming from you.
I could tell you exactly who would hate that. And that's Jeff Gundlach. So, you know, let's be honest. Jamie Dimon is a banker.
Yeah.
Jeff Gundlach is a fixed income asset manager.
They work together to make money, but they do not have, other than making money, they do not have common goals.
No, exactly. So if you're a fixed income asset manager, dumb question. Do you want rates to go up or down? Right.
You know,
banker,
and the answer to that really is very simple. Is you don't necessarily want them to go up, but you're more than happy letting them go up if you expect them to then precipitately decline.
Well, yeah, that, or if you have some nice swap agreements in place.
Well, yeah, there's always that. Well, it depends. But as a fixed income guy, you don't want change unless it's in your favor, right? You want it to go down.
Yeah, well, the majority of your principal, if you're a fixed income guy, the majority of your principal is in the loan itself. So screw the derivatives, just the loan. yeah, if you have a loan, you don't want interest rates to go up. And then, of course, if you're a banker, wild guess, do you want interest rates to go up or down?
They are your friend for the issuing of new loans and the modification of fluid loans. Interest rates going up, is it the enemy of fixed income or of fixed repayment loans?
Fixed debt. So I thought that was pretty funny. You know, if you just look at the Fed dot plot, it looks like, you know, we talked about this last time. The dot plot is essentially where it's like a chart. So all the different regional presidents of the Fed, this is where they think it's a plot with dots that show you where each regional president thinks interest rates are going to be
in the
next
short,
cycle,
medium, or, and then like long term, long run term.
Exactly.
They all still in the long run see this 2%. I still don't. I don't personally think they're right. I don't see it. Well, they have the power to get it there.
They do,
but I don't see it working out that way economically.
Well, it's like Pink Floyd, man. Welcome to the machine. The machine might break if inflation goes down to 2%. The machine might break, right? So. I don't know. We'll see. Jerome Powell himself at the press conference said we have yet to see the full effects of tightening. That's why I personally think this was a week ago when I saw this. CME futures for what they think the Fed funds rate is going to be in November, which is the next meeting. They're saying about a 25%, I think was what it was. You know, I could be off now because it was a week ago, but 25% chance that Fed funds rate is 25 basis points higher than it is now come November, right? So that's what I saw, 25% chance of a 25 basis point rate hike come November. That figure obviously is subject to change. So we'll see, but it's still relatively hawkish, man. I don't think the possibility of a rate hike in November is out of the cards, you know?
No, I don't either. And I mean, who was it today? Bowman came out today and she said she thinks that we're going to have to raise interest rates again. She sees, I think what she said is rising energy costs may damage the lowering of inflation, right? May drive inflation in a way that they don't want. So they may have to raise rates just to tamp that down. Having said that, like I understand where she is coming from, but... I'm not certain I agree with interest rates being the solution to an energy problem because energy doesn't grow on trees. Energy doesn't.
So who's Bowman? The former is it the Kansas person? Kansas City?
She's still there.
She took over for Stan Fisher.
Michelle Bowman.
Which region is she? I can't see.
Oh, she's just a member of the Board of Governors. She's not. She's not a president.
Oh, still a significant role.
Yeah, no. So she is a member of the Board of Governors. She was reappointed January 23rd, 2020. She was the State Bank Commissioner of Kansas in 2017 and 2018.
All right, I got my ice cube. I'm going to make another cocktail. Okay, so what did she say again? She said...
rising energy prices could stall the progress on inflation, and so interest rate hikes might be required to quash that.
The energy prices. So, this is a good tee up as I'm pouring myself another cocktail. It's martini, by the way, with Empress gin. It just looks so much more captivating than a martini with any other gin.
It does.
Not that it's better or worse. I'm just saying. I like this gin. I like the pea flower. You know.
Yeah. Pea flower adds the butterfly pea flower adds a it adds the purple color. It then changes with acid into a nice pink or a blue depending on how much acid there is. It also adds, in my opinion, a slight sweetness.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so I'm just eyeballing here my measurements, but. How much vermouth do you use in your martini with gins? Like, are you closer to 1 ounce or are you closer to half an ounce?
Ooh, yeah, half. I'm much lower on.
Good for you, man.
Yeah,
I'm not.
It's like obviously a dirty martini. Vermouth not a big vermouth involved. Thing, yeah. For a dry martini, half to half, maybe 3/4. It really depends on the gin.
Well, and I think martinis should be made with gin.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the poor man's stirring straw. I'm using the garnish of the lemon peel to stir the martini. Dropped it in there at the wrong angle. Oh, man. Dang it. Well, whatever. I don't think it'll affect the drink too much.
Well, at the same time, like, that's, I do that when I'm trying to save a dish. I'm trying to save a spoon.
Exactly. I don't want to use a spoon, right? I don't, like, I have the cocktail spoon. I have, like,
yeah.
I have, like, a dozen cocktail spoons or whatever. So, yeah. But, anyways, back to the whole Fed thing. Yeah, like, I thought it was pretty interesting. I felt like it was, it was what we expected. I don't think I'm pretty sure the markets cratered a little bit.
I don't think the markets were reacting to the Fed quite so much as they were reacting to an impending government shutdown where, it wasn't party rivalry. It was that the Speaker of the House couldn't get his own party to back his position. And the position that he could get them to vote for was dead on arrival in the Senate. You know, his own party, like Republican senators, weren't going to vote for this. So it's like, well, you know, you got to put something out that we can work with. You're also the reason this hasn't come up yet. So, that's the markets. They reacted to that. They, like I said, they reacted positively on the news that there was a continuing resolution for 45 days for the federal government that tried to come into today that didn't last out the day.
I think the reaction, it was so short lived that it was like, okay, that was a stupid idea. You know, maybe options traders definitely benefit from it, but you know, whatever. So there was that whole concept. It seemed like the tone there was a little bit more hawkish.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, 25% chance of a 25 basis point rate hike in November is another big takeaway. BOE and BOJ also left rates unchanged. So
yeah, you know, Japan and kind England, of a surprise from England.
Very big surprise. I thought it was a surprise from England, but I think they also have a lot of other issues going on that I think if you were to disrupt whatever routine was going on. It's kind of like the whole Jerome Powell thing of just, you know, because he said the full effects of the tightening have yet to be felt. And maybe that was kind of the same thing in Bank of England, in their jurisdiction. They were thinking like, all right, well, the effects here have yet to be felt. So let's not do anything more. Let's not tighten more.
I certainly agree with Jerome Powell. I think that he's right to hold off for another meeting, for this meeting. Going into November, we'll have to see where things are.
Well, and it's like the government shutdown thing. We kicked the can down the road, 45 days. So right before Thanksgiving, like you said, could be another shutdown. And I think the Fed, same deal. The idea of a recession, which I think technically we did have one, but the idea of a recession was kicked down the road.
I think we're still having one. It's just where it's happening in different sectors. And then it jumps.
Yeah, the idea of the rolling recession is still present. Like, PMI data is still, and we'll see, like, you know, new month, new quarter, right? We're going to see new economic data this month. You know, like I said, inflation's coming out here pretty soon, late next week. And I think later on this week, we have like jobs, September jobs and stuff like that. So we'll have an idea. We'll have an idea of what kind of progress the Fed made and whether or not we're being driven into a recession. But I think early 2024, this is what I keep hearing from people that keep coming on CNBC and Bloomberg and whatever else. They're saying 2024, we're going to have a recession. They're out of the soft landing. Like, people were in the soft landing camp after Jackson Hole. And then I think after that, they're like, I don't know about that. I think that was way too premature. We have to backtrack to our thesis at the beginning of the year and stick with that for the beginning of next year. So,
and I don't hate to pivot us, but I think I have to pivot us then. I don't think that at this point the soft landing is really under our control anymore. Then, at least not the Fed.
No, it's not
because at this point, it's not food. It's not food. It's not manufactured goods, although, you know, there's fluctuations in both those. But it's getting better. Mm-hmm. It's not like automobiles, which, again, that's a manufactured good. It's not something bought every day. The UAW strike, which is not helping. It isn't helping, but it's not a general strike. It's targeted to make negotiations move forward, which, fair enough. That's a smart union.
Yeah.
But
I don't think it's unnecessary, personally. And I think if you look at European PMI, like, European PMI data is very weak.
It was underwhelming.
Underwhelming is a very polite way to say it. I think it's weak. It's Kevin McCarthy weak, right? You know, so, like, sorry.
I like that.
Joke. That was a bad joke.
I don't think it was a joke. I think it was accurate. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Kevin McCarthy, this is fine. I'll dig on a Democrat. Kevin McCarthy's a weak leader. Chuck Schumer's feckless.
I personally have heard you. I've heard you personally trash on Nancy Pelosi a million times.
I don't care for her one bit. Like, yeah, no. I respect her as a parliamentarian, yeah. in the same way I respect Mitch McConnell as a parliamentarian.
That's what I'm
saying. I'd be more than happy if a plane containing the two of them and the two of them only crashed into the side of a mountain tomorrow.
That's what I'm saying, dude. I think you and I are in the same boat in that sense. We're like, you know, you and I have opposing political views. Mitch McConnell is one of those guys where I'm just...
Yeah. Actually, that's not fair.
On a few things, we have
opposing political views. I think we have very similar goals.
I think we have the same goals.
For both ourselves and then like the nation as a whole. I think we differ on how we get there.
Yeah.
And I think all the fun we have is in the conversation. Because I'm convinced I'm 94% right. I'm convinced that you at best are 7% right. And between the two, and I'm sure you feel the same way the other way around.
Dude, shoe fits another foot, man. Shoe fits another foot. Totally, dude.
Exactly. And that's why it works.
Yeah, dude. And like, that's why I love drinking with you, man, because I love the opposition that we have politically. It's so great.
Well, I know there's been a few times where it's just where like you've just said something and I'm like, well, fuck.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right. Go.
Well, we talked about NAFTA. Like, I know you're not opposed to NAFTA. Like, I don't forget where you stand on NAFTA, but I think NAFTA was a terrible agreement. And I think
free trade is inherently a good thing, which is really funny because that's a very right wing. Like, it's a conservative idea of free trade because the idea is if you can out compete people, you want free trade. If you're protectionist, if you can't out compete, you don't want free trade. You want protectionist trade. And so Democrats as a whole historically have been that protectionist trade, pro-union.
Yeah.
I'm pro-union, but that's for different reasons. It's because...
Well, but like, if you think about what NAFTA did, it closed down a lot of factories, right? So I think about 13,000...
Well, it moved them.
It moved them, but it closed down factories in the U.S. So like, I think the number was around 77,000 or 6,500 to 7,000 factories in the U.S. closed down since NAFTA was passed.
That's probably low.
Okay, it could be more,
On number of that's just me saying, like, number of factories across 50 states with 300 million people.
I mean, that's more or less the point.
It doesn't seem like it affects all that many.
Yeah.
But there are stakeholders, so it certainly affects some. But at the same time, like, what I would say is, like, okay, well, let's take economics and apply it into some politics a little bit, which is to say if you're dealing with someone who's like, our biggest concern is the southern border, which is an issue with the government funding the government shutdown. Is they're saying, there's not enough security on the southern border. I'm like, well, you know, the best way to make the southern border secure is that you you make Mexico's economy strong and viable so that they're not looking for better opportunities here.
Yeah.
They stay there.
No, that's a good point. Yeah.
And that means that on top of that, it means that we're buying Mexican goods. They're getting U.S. dollars. But then they have U.S. dollars with which to buy
American
U.S. goods. Right. You know, suddenly the trade flow increases and then both countries prosper, right? So it's a non-zero sum game.
But it's tough.
And
it's also a tough thing because we can't just make Mexico's economy better. You know, that's a huge investment.
No, we absolutely can't.
Yeah.
Like,
it's a huge investment.
Hell, we can't even make Kansas's economy better.
Yeah, exactly.
We gave them the Chiefs, except they're in Missouri.
Exactly, dude. And that's the thing. So like NAFTA was one of those agreements that it took away a lot of American jobs. And I'm not saying it was a good or a bad thing, but it moved them all essentially to Mexico.
It moved a lot of manufacturing of certain goods to Mexico. It took away a lot of the tariffs on steel, automobiles, things of that nature. And did that hurt Americans? Yes.
It did. It did. It hurt a lot of Americans.
The Americans that were earning their livelihood doing those things. Has it helped Americans with lower prices?
It has.
You can't lower prices at the same. You can't out lower prices while reducing incomes, right? So it's like I think you can't cut incomes in half unless you reduce prices across the board by more than that. And
that's just with
that's
autos.
Not
yeah.
how that works.
Yeah. So that's the reason why I don't think it was a good deal.
I think NAFTA was a good. I think it was a good deal. And the great thing about deals like that is that they can be renegotiated. And the trade bloc, the trade union, is a good thing. You want your economies to be connected, and you want your economies to be intertwined. There's a great expression I forget who originally said it, but it's when goods don't cross borders, armies do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so my thing is, you know, the U.S. has invaded Mexico twice. The U.S. has invaded Canada also twice. I don't see that coming ever again.
Yeah, no.
For those of you that want to know the history of those, but
yeah, but I mean, either way, like I think it's still fascinating in the sense that like like we have this protectionism environment, and we also have a free trade environment. Like, you know, let's profit as much as we can, but let's also make sure that our people are taken care of. And that brings me to energy in the sense that OPEC is just, they're making all these stupid policies. I would like to be energy dependent. I like being energy. I like the idea of being energy dependent.
Well, the U.S. is, for the most part.
Yes.
To be fair.
We are.
We're a net energy exporter. That does not mean independent.
No, it doesn't. No. Because we still have, if you look at energy imports, it's like freaking $200 billion a year or something like that, or whatever it is. You know, it's crazy.
But we export more than that.
We export like $500 billion.
In the energy sector.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. So it's, you know.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is like, I'd love to be energy independent as well.
Yeah.
There's a few roads to that.
But I also think, like, if you look at what's going to happen with inflation, and this is just kind of my tease for next Thursday whenever CPI comes out, I don't think. Do we see what happened the month of September? Carnage in the markets? Not carnage. That's a strong word. Not a good month in the markets for September.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was the worst. So the Q3 was the worst quarter in Europe for a year, and the month of September was the worst.
Yeah.
March? I don't know.
I don't know, but it's always like that. And there are a lot of market historians that are like, whenever September's this bad during a bull market run, you know, Q4 is always a good quarter. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen, you know?
I'm not certain either because here's the big thing going into Q4.
There's multiple case studies. It's like 86% of the time when January through August is a bull market run, September through December is a good run. And we had a few runs with that wasn't the case, but I still don't, like, 86% doesn't convince me, in my opinion.
No, it doesn't, right? Especially when, we'll go right back to energy after this, I promise, yes. But there's two things that happened today, basically, and that have just hit. And so it's 86% of those cases did not happen with record credit card debt.
Exactly.
In the U.S. consumer.
Exactly.
And those 86% of those cases didn't happen when student loan repayments just restarted at the beginning of Q4.
There we go.
After a 3-year hiatus. I do not see Q4 doing particularly well.
Well, if you think about it like this.
Especially if there's a government shutdown.
Yeah. What has driven the majority of, you know, Q1 through 2/3 of the way through Q3, what has driven these 7 months, these 8 months,
Visa
actually,
and MasterCard.
Is Visa...
is Capital One.
Consumers taking on loans, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, Capital One, whatever it is. So that has certainly driven, but that was driving the markets last year too. So stronger consumer sentiment, whatever it is, AI, M&A activity. For some reason, M&A activity, why did that? Was everybody trying to get things in like before the deadline? That's the only explanation I have for M&A.
I think so.
That's the only, like, you know, because CapEx is not... CapEx isn't down, but it's...
Well, it's not CapEx.
Yeah, CapEx isn't down, but it's plateaued, right? So it's just flat across the board, you know? Like, just go look at the St. Louis Fed thing. It's flat across... It's flat this year. It's not flat, but it's like it's starting to flatten out, right?
Diminishing return on CapEx is what we're seeing.
Yeah, but also CapEx is more expensive, so...
Absolutely.
I think that, you know, the fact that CapEx activity has kept up, the fact that M&A activity has kept up, the... strong consumer resilient consumer market in the U.S. has really propelled the markets, has really buoyed the markets up. This has been a weird year. I'm not saying that we're going to see carnage in the next 3 months because there could be more bullish sentiment coming out later on, right? We could see CPI at what like, just think about it. What if CPI comes in next week at 3.2%? Or what if it comes in at 2.9%? Like, I'm not saying it will. I'm not saying it will, but that would drive markets crazy.
It would.
Right?
And it wouldn't. And what I would say is it wouldn't be something that I have seen reflected in my average basket consumption. So,
you know,
if I saw that, I'd be like, well, where's that happening?
But if you,
part of me would be like, well, maybe I'll drive. Gas price, and I go, no, I won't drive.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say. If you look at energy, there's no indication that energy is going to come down. We saw, like I said, and this is what I was trying to get at earlier, but the month of September was a terrible month for equities, except for one sector. Guess what sector that is?
Was it football?
Was it
Nebraska football?
No,
that
definitely was not a good sector. But if you look at football as a sector, if it was a publicly traded sector, it probably would have been bullish, but no. Of the 14 sectors or whatever it is, 17 sectors.
Was it energy?
It was freaking energy. Do you know why it was energy?
Yeah.
I feel like we all know.
Well, OPEC.
Exactly.
OPEC hasn't been. OPEC's been about as stingy as you can get. They're not like grandma at like Thanksgiving who thinks you're too skinny. They're like,
no, they're like,
I don't have another analogy for that. My grandma's always thought I was too skinny.
I have no idea, but you know, my mom has told my cousins at some point that they need to go to the gym. Maybe it's like that.
Well, we can't all be college athletes like you and your twin brother, who is also a college athlete. Hey,
well,
Nate, how you doing?
Hold on.
No, he's not over your shoulder.
I was just saying. I turned around. I was like, what the heck? Oh, man, I'm drinking all the gin.
Yeah, Nate heard someone say something nice about him, so he popped in the room. He just knew.
There's nothing nice to say about that guy.
He's a better golfer than me.
Okay. He's not better than me, though.
To be fair, I've never golfed other than putt-putt, never in my life.
Well, I did play golf at CFA Society Minnesota chapter last week. Great event. You know, hats off to the CFA Minnesota Society. I will say that real quick.
How far under par were you?
Our team was only 14 under par. So, like, we didn't play as well as we thought. I missed some putts, but I made it. I sank a 40-foot eagle putt, so.
Aaron, you hate putting.
I do hate putting.
That's like, awesome, though, dude. A 40-foot eagle putt?
I remember I hit a shot to sink. I hit, like, there were, like, three shots in a row where me and this other guy in the group that was a fantastic golfer, charter holder in Minnesota. I don't want to say his name, but he hit a shot to 6 feet. I hit a shot to 6 feet. We took his shot, uphill putt. Someone else made the putt, and I'm like, thank God, because I don't want to putt.
Pressure's off.
Exactly. But, like, I made two mega long putts, man. Like, I'm saying, like, Anaconda style putts, dude. Just freaking long. And yeah, it was great. It was great. I had a lot of fun at that event. But whatever. Anyways, energy prices. I generally don't think that CPI is going to come in weaker. If it comes in weaker, I'll be surprised. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. I don't think it will.
Yeah. And, you know, I wish the Fed didn't have this PCE thing. And I appreciate Michelle Bowman for saying what she said, that the Fed needs to raise interest rates for the lowering of energy prices. I appreciate her saying that. But
interest rates don't affect energy prices when it's OPEC.
When it's OPEC
reducing the flow because they know that the U.S. hasn't opened a new oil refinery since 1977. The U.S. hasn't built a new nuclear power plant since 1979.
Yeah,
that the U.S. closed what, 7 oil refineries or 5 oil refineries in the last
4 years,
the last few
5 years, 4 or 5 years. Yeah.
The Western world will not buy Russian oil or natural gas for more than $60 a barrel for oil specifically.
And if you think about closing these oil refineries, it's not like it's not an easy thing to do because these things are generating millions and billions of dollars a month. You know, like refineries are.
I think the average oil refinery is supposed to generate something like $5 billion in profit a year.
Yeah, dude. So like,
I wouldn't turn one off if I owned one.
Yeah.
If it was generating $5 billion in profit for me.
So why would you? And that's the thing is like, so OPEC has not been kind to energy prices. If you look at gas prices throughout the year, gas prices, personally, in the state of Arizona that I live in the month of September, it went from like $3.79 to about low five.
Yeah, no. But, and that's the thing, is like interest rates in the U.S. will not affect
what OPEC does.
Saudi Arabia's decision.
No.
Or Venezuela's decision. Any of the rest of the cartel, because they know. They're like, huh. Oh, yeah. They won't buy oil from this guy.
Yeah.
And we're in it for the money.
Yeah.
So we're going to restrict the supply.
Yeah, and like you said, like OPEC is super stingy with that. So people want to blame Joe Biden for energy prices. Believe me, I want to blame Joe Biden for energy prices too. It's not his fault. Like it's OPEC. Right? OPEC is the one that's restricting supply. I don't think Joe Biden's not kind to it. He's not helping. But like,
yeah, but
you know.
But to be fair, like you look at the sentiment from like some of the CEOs. Like Chevron's CEO has said he doesn't think another oil refinery will open in the United States ever again. It takes at the very least 5 years to open an oil refinery in the U.S. 5 to 7 is what kind of the market says is that's how long it takes
to open one.
To get it open.
And then, yeah,
not even to get it to be a profitable refinery to get it open.
Just get open like, to go profitable.
The last
30 new years
one opened 55 years ago.
What?
No, 46 years ago. The last The last oil refinery opened 46 years ago in the U.S. Yeah.
And people think, okay, so a lot of refineries closed down in the last 4 years. It's not like you turn on a light switch and it turns back on. I think we talked about this earlier this year.
Mm-mm.
But like the production of oil is not, that's not the issue here. Everything is operating at max cap in terms of refinery goes. They can't refine oil fast enough. And the reason for this is because we had a lot of refineries closed in the last, 4 or 5 years-ish? So it's, you know, since 2019 to 2018. I think it was 2019 was when it really started to tumble down. But
yeah.
These things, you don't turn on a light switch and these refineries are back on. It's this long, drawn-out process.
It's very similar to the steel foundries in China. Like,
yeah.
They're not meant to turn off.
Yeah.
They're not meant to turn off.
They take like 15 years to be turned back on, and then they take like another 7 years to actually start making money again. So if you're Chevron and you're like, I have this refinery in Paris, Texas, in the middle of nowhere that's shut down, and oil is at this price point that I kind of like, I want to turn this refinery back on. It's like, okay, go ahead, turn it back on. But it's at least 22 to 25 years before you actually make money from this at the current price point.
Well, exactly right. So, it's that whole, well, I want to turn it back on at this price, but can I guarantee that in 5 years, when I get things running smoothly, at best, not even turn one back on. I want to build one.
You want to build
5
one?
5 years is my best from like starting construction, not from like starting my planning, getting my permissions, all that.
But it's starting construction to one barrel of oil produced, 5 years, which is not like not a profitable point if you think about. Obviously not.
Absolutely but not. Like, and so I'm sitting here going like, oh, I like the price point right now. Can I guarantee it'll be this in 5 years? And if the answer is no, or if you're looking at a regulatory environment or a political environment,
it's not even 5 years. It's more like, if you build one, it's like, if you think about it like this, building one and turning on a refinery is about the same time frame for you to start making money about, right?
Yeah.
So,
but the real thing is like, it's, if you stop and think like, well, that's if nothing changes in tax environment,
yep.
Regulatory environment,
yep.
Legal requirements to run anything, insurance requirements, energy prices, all whatever. These things.
But like new products, new substitutes, right? So if nuclear energy takes off, that's not even accounted for in terms of oil, you know? So like, what if all of a sudden nuclear energy takes off?
Yeah, it comes right back.
People are welcome to the, you know, people are welcome to the idea of nuclear energy and, you know, and people realize, first of all, I'm a huge advocate of nuclear energy personally, so I'll kind of get that out of the way. But
me too.
There you go. You heard it. Two opposing political views that are both advocates of nuclear energy.
Yeah.
Anyways.
No, I love.
Yeah.
I love nuclear power.
Yeah, me too. But backtracking, you know, oil and gas. Let's just say they're just like, all right, we don't know if there's a threat of new entrants like nuclear energy because still. For some reason, we're not using.
It's not a new entrant. It's an old entrant.
It's old, but like nobody. Like, okay, or who's using it right now?
It's newer than burning oil. That's true, but it's
okay. But, so like,
you know, the last oil refinery was opened in 1977. The last nuclear power plant was opened in 1979. There's nothing new since 1979.
Okay, yeah, so but like, I mean, like, who's like plugging in their house or their generator or you know filling up their gas tanks with nuclear energy. Nobody's doing that.
Well, there's actually, so my thing is, yeah, there's a few smaller companies that are working on like salt reactors smaller. And I'm a huge proponent of that. Like the idea of like a.
Me too.
Not necessarily like every house has its own nuclear pile. That doesn't seem feasible.
No, but like, I bring this up because like if you're Chevron and you're turning, like you're toying with the idea of turning on a new refinery, it's like, okay, there's that threat.
Oh yeah,
and there's this the political regulatory,
well, the
threat.
Worst part, yeah, with, you know, the, I see what you mean with the nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
it's like one, I don't, the government already doesn't like me, and two, this nuclear power plant, I know they already exist, I know they already work, and I know that they produce more power more efficiently for less money,
for way less money,
a lot less pollution.
Yeah, exactly.
And no CO2. Why would I try to compete with that?
Yeah, exactly.
And the only way you do that is if you go like, well, I can get a dollar more doing it, building this new refinery, than I can not.
But that's what I'm saying. Like,
and that requires 18 years of commitment.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, so like, yeah. You don't know how different the landscape is going to be 18 years from now. But it sucks now because gas prices, at least in Arizona, are above $5 a gallon again. right? And that sucks. Like, nobody likes that.
Yeah, I don't care for it.
Yeah.
One bit.
So essentially what I'm trying to say is short-term CPI comes out. I don't know who is out there trying to build to you know, turn on a new oil refinery or build a new oil refinery. I think, you know, because of the political landscape and because of the technological landscape and all that kind of stuff, I think new oil refineries or turning on older oil refineries, I don't think it's going to be a thing. I think the Chevron CEO has a point. I don't know if he's right or not, but I think he's got a great point.
I think he's wrong. The problem is, like I said, the youngest one is 47 years old at this point.
Yeah.
Some of these factories some of these refineries we're seeing, and some of these refineries are having serious problems, fires and other things.
Yeah.
You know, they're 100 years old.
Yeah. And they've been operating at max cap. None of them have been maintained.
They don't get turned off.
Yeah.
So, let me tell you.
Yeah.
My boy Aaron's is a wicked good golfer. But if he has to golf 365 games a year, whatever 365 times 18 is, and we all have calculators, so I'm not going to do that math. Because this analogy is on the fly.
I will tell you this.
I'm willing to
bet. My scoring average.
At the end of 3 years of this, he might be able to make Tiger Woods play for it.
You know what? I'll say this. If I had to play in a tournament every single day for the next, let's call it 1,000 days.
Yeah, 3 years, fine.
If that were to happen, I can tell you that the last 400 days, my scoring average would be in the 90s. There's no way. There's no way.
Yeah.
My score.
I'm just thinking at the end, it's the work.
Yes. There's just no way.
It's gonna the amount of physical work is going to overcome the improvement.
Yeah, I need some R&R. I need to go back and figure out what I'm doing wrong and practice a little bit. But if I'm playing that day, I'm not practicing. You know, like every swing
matters. Every little bit of physical activity matters.
Every
pump of
every shot.
Every little pump of the.
Essentially, yeah. Every shot matters. Every shot matters.
And
if you're in a mental rut, you're just gonna sink into that mental rut. It's tough. But like you said, it's kind of the same deal. Like these old refineries are the same. Like you operate these old refineries 1,000 days in a row, which a lot of these have been, you know, going at max cap for way more than that.
Longer than that.
Way longer than that.
3 years, guys.
Yeah, it's just shy of 3 years. Yeah, so. You know, a lot of these refineries have been operating at max cap for a long time. But yeah, 1,000 days is just shy of 3 years. But like, they've been going at max cap for forever. And are they going to shut down for maintenance? No. Why would they?
And it shows they catch on fire and they explode.
Yeah. Why would they halt at this critical point in the supply chain when oil is at this price point, you know? So it's tough. You know, you'd like to think that high prices is the cure for high prices, but it's not in the energy space because of
this. Well, not when high prices are the cure for low or negative prices. So oil is sitting here going, yeah, no, 2020 was awful. $19 a barrel.
There you go.
So negative $58 a barrel in the futures.
So OPEC is like,
we're going to try and get our money back.
Yeah. OPEC is like, let's recoup that. And then on top of that,
yeah,
nobody's toying with the idea of nuclear energy, and I think it's a good concept.
Well, they are, but they're smaller firms. No major electricity producers are actually building nuclear power plants. And the reason they're not, and it's if you really want to bring in the wild man of Lincoln, Nebraska, via Detroit, Michigan, we could talk about our boy Champ. Mm-hmm. But it's that
angry Nebraskan villager. Yes. That's who he is.
He's an institution, is what he is. Love that man.
Me too. I love that guy. But yes.
But you know, the big problem with nuclear energy is everyone complains like, "Oh, the nuclear waste." Well, the big one is they go like, "Well, what about the nuclear disasters?" And my response to that is, "Well, the worst nuclear disaster in civilian power in the U.S. is Three Mile Island, and disaster is a strong word
for that one.
Things did not go correctly. The people running it didn't understand it." The biggest issue there was PR, as I view it.
Well, that was just, that was literally just a political ploy. There was a newspaper company that wanted to get more clicks. You know,
the problem was there had been a movie called the China Syndrome, I think. It had come out like a year before, and it was a very similar thing that happened.
Yeah.
The problem is that the movie, everything went wrong. And it was all bad. And in reality, like,
it was fine. It was like two things went wrong.
We designed this to be impervious to A, B, C, D, and E.
Yeah, it was like, it was like a valve.
It went wrong because we didn't expect A, C, and D to happen. But
yeah, it was like a valve.
So yeah,
like
bad valve coolant.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, so it was that. And like, if you look at, I don't know what happened with Chernobyl, but if you look at Fukushima, Fukushima was
Chernobyl was people who didn't understand how the power plant worked did something that the power. Yeah, no, that was an explosive meltdown. Yeah. Like, it wasn't even a meltdown. Well, that was actually a nuclear explosion.
Yeah, and Fukushima was just an issue. Fukushima was just bad architecture. It was, and like, you should, like, this is something that, like, you look and you.
Not architecture, but.
Engineer, whatever you want to call it. But
planning, like, and design.
Yeah, but like, you design this nuclear power plant on an island in Japan, and it's like, okay.
Well, on the coast. On the,
oh, yeah, so.
All of Japan's
whatever. Island. Yeah, so, yeah, I, that's what I'm saying. Like, Japan is. Like, it's all on a coast. But anyways, you design this freaking nuclear power plant, and you're like, let's not account for flooding. You know, and then, of course.
And they did, well, the problem is they did account for flooding, but they didn't account for flooding right after an earthquake.
Exactly. Okay, so,
right? So they were like,
it's fine. They did
in the event of an earthquake, boom, the diesel plants will switch on. Oh, in the event of a flood, well, we can shut that down because we'll see the water coming. Well, they never thought that one would lead to the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They kind of have a flood in the sense that they built this 3 foot butter. They did build like a 3 foot ish buffer. Sorry.
Breakwater.
Yeah, exactly. Underneath the factory, which, like, if you think about it, 3 feet when a tsunami hits, not a huge protector, well, right? It's probably,
I have to imagine it was based on the idea that, like, oh, a 3 foot tsunami, that's the kind of thing that we could like that might happen without us like seeing any buildup.
Yeah.
But the real thing is like, but you got what you got. How big was that earthquake? And they're like, what was this? And I'm like, well, okay.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. This was obviously power plants will no longer be designed with the same flaw. And
of course, yeah,
systems will be improved to deal with the issue in future.
Yeah, well, that's what,
having said that,
and that's what I'm saying. Know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I think the energy crisis. I am bullish on CPI. I think CPI is going to come in hotter in October. Personally,
I agree. Is
PCE going to come in hotter? I don't think so. That's what the Fed looks at. But either way, like the way they designed Fukushima, it was like using a drunkenomics sweater for a bulletproof vest, which is not something that I advocate you to do.
It's not going to make you bulletproof, but it might make them less likely to shoot you. And if you need 100% to know where to find said sweater, said hoodie, drunkenomics.myspreadshop.com.
Yeah, that's drunkenomics.myspreadshop.com. Get a hoodie.
It's not bulletproof,
but it'll look freaking great on you. I already know it, dude. I already know it. It'll look better than you
on a Versace suit. Yeah. To get into trouble like that.
Exactly, dude.
If you're already bulletproof, if you don't need
this Drunkenomics hoodie,
if you're doing awesome,
check us out.
Check us out at patreon.com/drunkenomics.
Yes.
No, drunkenomical?
No, it's drunkenomics. patreon.com/drunkenomics. Anything there is very much greatly appreciated. We're all bartenders by trade. So if you want to help us, you know, it's not our full-time jobs. As you know, last week I was out because of my full-time job. But,
and as we obviously disclose every week, please don't think that we're discussing a public line because of our full-time jobs.
Exactly. Check us out there. You know, if you want to help us,
tip in the tip jar.
Pay for this.
It helps Aaron keep him. It helps us keep Aaron in the Empress Gin. It helps us keep our limes limey and our lemons fresh.
Yeah, look at this lime. That's great.
If you can't do that, write a review.
Yeah.
Hopefully a nice review, but a review. It helps us find new people. It helps new people find us. And it helps us grow, which is huge.
Yeah, seriously, anything that's greatly appreciated. But until then, you know, our taglines, please do these things if you can. Continue to play chess, not checkers. Continue to not brag, but just say. Continue to fill and kill as I have filled and killed. And most importantly...
I have also.
Nice, dude, I'm so proud of you. But most importantly, do that one thing. What's it called again?
Well, stay drunkenomical out there, guys.
That's what it is. Cheers, my friend.
Cheers.